See, may it please the court and justices. All right, I'm going to jump right in here. This is a little bit of an unusual case as far as the appellate cases that I've had, and that the review of this court on this case is very narrow. This is a four-page traditional summary judgment on a single issue with respect to claims filed by my clients. The issue and the affirmative defense, the only review of this court on that summary judgment is the affirmative defense of res judicata. So every inquiry for this court is bound by the limitation of res judicata and the evidence, of course, that was presented in the summary judgment at the trial court. With respect to res judicata, in this case is again unusual in that there's no judgment, there's no summary judgment, there's no motion to dismiss. What there is a non-suits originally entered without prejudice, pro se, by the appellees that they have attempted to bootstrap into a allegation that they amount to a decision on the merits. These are their own non-suits, and they're trying to use them in a way to prejudice our claims, our affirmative claims that we filed in this 2020 case.
Didn't that non-suits and didn't that order signed by the court, and my computer still booting up this morning, also take into a place that there was counterclaims by your client made in that case?
We made counterclaims, and the judge, they were filed after the non-suits. And in the underlying case, the 18 case, the original motion by the Galvans was that our non-suits close the case, our spontaneous non-suits in this case. And we'd already been up to the Court of Appeals, to this Court of Appeals, and received a reversal on an anti-SLAPP motion, which was subsequently granted back in June of 2021. And the court took it under advisement and for a long time, and then ultimately ruled on a motion for clarification that the filing of those non-suits, because they occurred prior to time under the clear law that, you know, under the law that non-suits are effective when filed, meant that I and my clients had no opportunity to file into that case because she determined they ended the case except for the pending sanctions claim related to the anti-SLAPP.
But that was related to the defamation claim only, correct? Not the other claim of intentional infliction of emotional distress?
Well, there are different intentional infliction claims. They originally had one, and they filed that. They non-suited all their claims, and she accepted in the 18 case, accepted all of them except for the defamation non-suit because we had a prior and pending sanctions motion only on the defamation claim. So when we went to court in June of 2021, that was only as to the consequences of the anti-SLAPP motion in this court's opinion, granting a reversing and rendering on the anti-SLAPP motion, and we had a hearing on that. So that would have only really related to the defamation.
And the sanctions that were awarded in the defamation case or the anti-SLAPP portion, those sanctions were awarded in regards to the anti-SLAPP motion, not on the merits of the defamation, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But when the counterclaim was filed, it was filed for malicious prosecution and infliction of emotional distress.
Correct, Your Honor.
And did those not the order of October 2020, the final order, take into account also the counterclaims?
Well after the fact, Your Honor, because the court had considered it for some time.
Right.
But that order is not an order of dismissal with prejudice. The word prejudice is not in there. It's just if you read the underlying motion, which is the motion for clarification, which was not included in the evidence originally filed in this summary judgment by appellees. The motion wasn't, the order was. I've included the motion. The motion is that in their position, the Galvan's position and the trial court all along was that we're gonna non-suit this. Frankly, it was an attempt to avoid the sanctions. They had fired their first lawyers and had not yet got a second lawyer, and they went down and non-suited pro se, trying to not have their deposition taken, which would have been compelled, and to avoid the sanctions process in relation to the finishing of the anti-SLAPP motion. And the court determined that the filing of those was good enough and ended the case except for this lingering sanctions thing. And we accepted, you know, I disagreed with it, but I accepted it. And we moved on and filed those claims as independent claims. It may help at this point to give just a quick factual background. I know the court's familiar with this, having heard some of it once, but the initial kind of incident that some of the, that these two cases arise from, the 18 and the 2020 case, goes back to a 2007 incident where the appellee, Mr. Richard Galvan, who was acting as a youth pastor at the time, according to this court's finding in the prior appellate opinion, convinced 17-year-old Hannah Cruz to meet him outside of church and sleep with him. We alleged that was a sexual assault in the under the penal code in the original case, in the original anti-SLAPP motion, and this court agreed that it was a matter of public concern as its basis for the anti-SLAPP. That was filed in 2018. The court's denial was in early 2019. We filed an appeal. That was originally filed early 2019, and this court's opinion reversing and granting the anti-SLAPP motion was in October 2019, and the mandate came down from this court in January of 2020. So that's when we really are able to start our litigation, because the Galvans had opposed any discovery while the anti-SLAPP was pending, and certainly while the appeal was pending. We attempted to depose them, sent them written discovery. They quashed our depositions, and then they had been ordered by February of 2020. Then, as they were approaching, they filed non-suits. Richard filed the first one pro se April 14th, and attempted, I think, to non-suit both the Galvans, even though he's not a lawyer, and subsequently, I assume from some advice, Sonia Galvan filed a separate pro se non-suit, both of those without prejudice, in April 17th.
In 2020.
Getting
and that was the motion for clarification that led ultimately to the October
2020 order. Right, so what had happened, for reasons, from my perspective, and as the one doing this, basically for judicial economy, we had not been able to depose the Galvans. We didn't have much discovery from them yet, but I wanted to go ahead and try to get everything in this case tried in one case, so I filed counterclaims after Sonia filed her non-suit.
Yeah, my understanding is appellees, they contend that your only bite at the apple would have been to appeal that order.
Yeah, that's incorrect, Your Honor. I'm happy to address that if you want
sure.
me to now.
Sure.
Their basis for that is a case called Travelers v. Yokeem. And in that case, strikingly different from our case, what happened was a plaintiff in that case, I assume Yokeem, his plaintiff's case was called for trial. He non-suited his case one day before trial. And the trial court exercised its discretion, I think, regarding abuse of the non-suit rule, and issued an order dismissing the case with prejudice. And it says that specifically in the order, and it was his non-suit. So he non-suited, the court issues an order that says this is dismissed with prejudice, and then he did not appeal that finding of prejudice. And what the court ruled is because he didn't appeal it, whether or not there was an error in the court's judgment about issuing the order with prejudice, he had to appeal it in that case. In our case, the non-suits were filed voluntarily by the opposing party, which they're now seeking to inure res judicata from as to us, the opposing party. So what they are trying
to... There's no dispute that this was never tried to a jury, never tried to the bench, or either party submitted summary judgments in the first case.
That is correct. That's correct, Your Honor. There's been no determination on traditional determination on the merits at all. The argument is somehow that these non-suits prevented us from being able to file a subsequent lawsuit. I think the black letter law is clear that the non-suit places the parties taken a non-suit taken by a party renders the lawsuit a nullity and places the parties in the same position that they would have been had the suit not been filed. That's Epps v. Fowler, and it does not prevent a defendant from bringing its own claims for affirmative relief later. That's in my brief, City of Dallas v. Albert.
And the new cases were brought within the statute of limitations. That's not an issue, correct?
That's not been an issue. So the issue
Would you agree with me, though, that the issues that are brought up in the subsequent lawsuit, the one we're here for, are exactly, if not similar, to the counterclaim lawsuits?
Yes and no, Your Honor. I'll only explain some fact pattern about that. The issues in the Galvan's lawsuit is that we contended, and I think were vindicated on, that he had filed this lawsuit over something that was true and it was a matter of public concern, hence our anti-SLAPP motion.
Right.
our claims, which we're not here to really talk about any of the other merits or the elements of malicious prosecution, but those are claims that are derivative of the decision of this court and ultimately the trial court on the Galvan's claims. And the reason for that is once I took the Galvan's depositions, Ms. Galvan admitted that she signed a false affidavit. She said to get a she averred twice in the original lawsuit to get a TRO that Mr. Cruz had threatened her with imminent bodily injury. Now, this was from on a phone call from Fort Worth, and in the deposition, she acknowledged that she was not threatened by Mr. Cruz, and it was not immediate or anything like that. So what we have then is a filing of a lawsuit for an ulterior motive, which is to stifle the victim's speech, and that fits into malicious prosecution as an independent but derivative claim. And my understanding of the law is quoted in the brief of malicious prosecution claims is you have to have an adverse adjudication before the claim matures, and those cases are cited in the brief. So
again, going back to my question, you said that yes and no.
Right.
So what was similar about your all, and what is not similar?
All of this arises from something that happened in 2007 between Hannah
right.
Cruz and Galvan. But our malicious prosecution claims are about the filing of a lawsuit for an ulterior motive with falsely pled verified facts in the petition. So it's
but
not.
Wasn't that the same allegations you made in your counterclaim of 2020?
The counterclaim in 2018 that I filed, trying to keep it all in one case that the court ruled was after the non-suits. Those counterclaims that I filed in 2020 are the same as the ones I filed later on after the decision on the clarification
motion.
Okay,
Mr. Chapman, now you've confused me.
Okay. I'm sorry.
That's okay. We're going to unconfuse myself. So was there pending counterclaims at the time that the non-suit was filed by the Galvans?
No.
Okay, so there was no counterclaim.
No, I missed it. I was waiting for more discovery before I filed my counterclaims.
Okay, right now it seemed like you said there were some in 2018, and I thought, well, I didn't think there was anything filed until 2020.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
I apologize if I misspoke somehow. The counterclaims were admittedly filed after their non-suits, which is why if you read in total the motion for clarification, what they argued in the trial court then was that this wipes out the lawsuit, and she said, oh, yeah, you're right, it wipes out the lawsuit. It was filed first. And I'll accept that. That is fine. We did accept that. But that means we're back and standing in the same position we were in before, and we get to file our current lawsuit, the 2020 case. And there's no way that is res judicata.
So hypothetically, if then they countersued you in this case for the same allegations, there would be no res judicata? Is that what you're
saying? That's correct. If they want to countersue us, I think the only thing that res judicata would attach to in this 2020 case, they filed, I think, 7 different causes of action originally in 2018, and to the extent that those are maybe still alive for limitations, they may not be, but if they're free to file them, and I'm free to defend them. The only one that would be res judicata, I think, would be the defamation claim, which was decided on the anti-SLAPP basis by this court. They're certainly free to file any claims they want against us as counterclaims.
Okay.
Because we got left standing in the same shoes that we were in. Having said that, I think at a hearing, one of the Galvans may have tried to change their non-suits from without prejudice to with prejudice, but that we'd have to talk about that later. But in concept, they can file any claims they want against us as counterclaims in this case once we get back to where we can litigate it. So with respect to the waiver argument, it doesn't hold water. The order here does not say with prejudice. It wasn't asked for that way, and there's no adjudication. The compulsory counterclaim issue, I guess I'll go ahead and address that very briefly, was not an issue ever raised in their summary judgment, except they called them compulsory counterclaims, but they didn't produce evidence or make an argument of that. Even so, they're not compulsory because they didn't attach or accrue until after we took depositions and then months later got an adjudication from this court ending the active claims. So what we have here simply is, with all the convoluted timeline of two cases, it's just no evidence in their summary judgment motion of any adjudication on the merits, period. And I'll thank the court for your time.
All right, Ms. Voss, whenever you're ready to proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. Good morning.
Morning.
I'm here on behalf of the Appalese, the Galvans. And Mr. Chapman was correct. This is solely about res judicata. And the reasoning behind that doctrine is to bring an end to litigation, to maintain stability of court decisions, promote judicial economy, and also to prevent a double recovery. And because of those policy reasons, Texas law bars a second suit on a claim that could have been litigated in a prior lawsuit or that was litigated and then abandoned. And that's what we have in this case. The counterclaims that were raised in the 2018 litigation were abandoned when the Cruises failed to appeal from the adverse judgment in the 2018 case. There are two elements.
So talk to me a little bit more about this order, Ms. Voss, that was signed in 2020. The appellant seems to argue this morning that that really is just effectuating the plaintiff's case in that case and not his counterclaims.
Well, so that is exactly the first thing that I was going to talk about, because
okay.
we have been talking ad nauseum about non-suits and the effect of non-suits and the effect of the non-suits on the counterclaims. Those arguments should have been raised in an appeal from the first judgment. Now, what we have is a final judgment on the merits, and I'll explain why
okay.
that
let
is.
Let me ask you this question, Ms. Voss, I know that you always want to talk more than me ask questions, but the once the non-suits are filed, this is a standard law school question, right? If it's a good non-suit, which I guess this court ascertained it was, except for the defamation portion, then wasn't there not anything for the counterclaims to attach to had they gone away?
No, that's absolutely wrong.
Okay.
Because the defamation claims had not been fully resolved. There was no final judgment. The court expressly refused to accept a non-suit on the defamation claims. So before the court signed a final judgment dismissing that claim and awarding the attorney's fees and sanctions and costs that this court ordered the trial court to consider to fully resolve that issue, there was still a live suit. The counterclaims were filed into it. Now, my trial counsel, I was not part of that team, the Galvans individually, pro se, argued that the non-suits barred the counterclaims, but the fact is that the Cruises vehemently argued that that was wrong.
So wouldn't they have been able to just file the other claims in a separate suit other than the defamation? If that's what you're saying, is that the defamation was still alive, so they should have sued with the other causes of action in this case, or in the first case, the 18 case.
What I am saying is that once they brought those counterclaims in the 2018 case, and the case, one claim, actually all the claims in that case were resolved on the merits, and if I can explain why, I think you'll understand. They should have brought all of those claims and fought for them to keep them alive through an appeal. And once they failed to do that, those become barred by res judicata. And so I want to take a step back and talk to you about why these non-suits are wholly irrelevant in this case. The non-suits were initially without prejudice, right? Before the counterclaims were filed, there was a non-suit that was filed, attempted to be filed by Mr. Galvan. And then Mrs. Galvan did not actually file a non-suit until after the counterclaims were filed.
Okay,
and that's borne out in the record. Now, those initial ones were without prejudice. Later, the trial court accepted the amended notice of non-suit. That is actually reflected in the record in a court order. The court said, I am dismissing all of these claims except for defamation with prejudice. A dismissal on a non-suit with prejudice is an adjudication, a final adjudication of that claim on the merits. That is well established in the case law. It's in the Epps case that Mr. Chapman has cited to this court. A non-suit with prejudice is a final adjudication on the merits. So those claims were finally adjudicated. The defamation claims, the case law also says that a TCPA dismissal is a final adjudication of that claim on the merits. Now, here's where the disconnect comes between our arguments. Mr. Chapman believes that his claim had to get resolved on the merits with a trial or a summary judgment or something like that. That's not how res judicata works. Res judicata bars claims that are litigated, claims that could have been litigated. If Mr. Chapman's argument were correct, we wouldn't need the transactional approach to decide whether a claim could have been brought in the initial litigation, because if it wasn't litigated to a final judgment through a summary judgment or a trial, it wouldn't be barred. But that's not how any of this works. All you need is one claim that has gone to a final judgment on the merits. And then if another claim gets wrapped up into that final judgment, then it is also barred by res judicata. And I have some cases to give you that are not in our briefs.
Okay.
I'm happy to submit a supplemental brief on this.
How about you give us a letter brief, if that's okay with the panel on those cases? Is that okay?
That's fine. Sure.
That way I make sure that what I'm writing down on my notes is correct.
Okay, sure. Well, I can talk to you about one of them. There are a couple. And I will submit a brief so you have the sites and everything. The first one's called Zurita versus Lombana. This case is a case where you had a dentist who owned a office space, and he leased some office space to a doctor. They got in a dispute over the lease. Dentist sues doctor. Doctor counterclaims against dentist. And then dentist counterclaims back. So you have plaintiff suing, defendant counterclaiming, plaintiff counterclaiming. Well, in that first case, the trial court struck the dentist's counterclaims back and said that they were too late, they were untimely, they weren't filed properly. So then the dentist appeals and gets a reversal of, the case goes to trial and the dentist loses on his other claims. They go up on appeal. The dentist prevails on appeal, but he doesn't get a remand of the claims that were stricken. He doesn't get that from the Court of Appeals. He doesn't even ask for that. So then what he does, after that judgment becomes final, he goes and he tries to sue the doctor again on those claims that were stricken. That wasn't a trial on the merits. There was no summary judgment, but there was a final determination of that case on the merits, and the Court of Appeals said, sorry, res judicata, it is too late for you to bring these claims. If you wanted to preserve those erroneously stricken claims, you should have asked the Court of Appeals to remand them for you so that you could proceed in the original lawsuit. And that is exactly what happened here in this case. Now, the effect of the non-suits, whether the trial court erroneously dismissed the counterclaim, that is an issue that, right or wrong, should have been resolved in the 2018 litigation. And because it wasn't, it becomes a claim that is abandoned. And you can look at the Citizen Insurance case versus Dakich case from the Texas Supreme Court, which we have cited. And in that case, it was a class action claim where a class representative wanted to abandon several claims that had been pleaded because it was going to be easier to get the Texas Securities Act claims certified as a class. And the Supreme Court said, wait a minute, no. If you do that, if you have pleaded these claims on behalf of a class and then you drop some of them because you want to fit into this procedural posture, then that is going to bar the other class members from later bringing these claims, because if you bring a claim in litigation and then you abandon it and you allow one of the claims to go to a final judgment on the merits, the rest of them are all barred. And so the court would not allow the class certification to proceed because of the way that those claims had been abandoned and the harm that would befall to the class because of the res judicata effect. And so you can see the Supreme Court has already said, if you allow any of your claims to go to a final judgment, the ones you abandon, you've lost them. And I want to point out, the defamation claim that was resolved on the merits through the TCPA motion, it was resolved against the Galvans, but it was also a claim that was resolved in favor of the Cruises because they had a claim under the TCPA for damages in the form of attorney's fees, sanctions, costs, and expenses. So they let one of their claims go to a final judgment on the merits, and then they let these others in their counterclaim fall to the wayside and failed to appeal those. So that, under the case law, is an abandonment. And I think the Joaquin, the Travelers versus Joaquin case.
So you're saying that the granting of a TCPA motion is an equivalent to a judgment on the merits of a claim?
It is. It is. And I can give you a cite to a case that says that it is a final judgment on the merits. Now, where did it go? It's called Better Business Bureau of Metropolitan Houston versus John Moore Services, Inc. And I can put that also into the site on that into the letter brief that I file for the court.
Does the order in that is signed by the judge take care of the defamation in far as attorney's fees and costs? I'm trying to find it. I couldn't locate it on my...
The June, I believe it's a June 9th, 2020 order.
June 9th, 2020 order.
There is an unsigned copy that is in the record, but everyone agrees that on that date the court signed the order. It granted a dismissal with prejudice of the defamation and the defamation per se claims. It granted attorney's fees of $25,800, TCPA sanctions of $45,000, costs, expenses, and then it denied the Rule 13 sanctions request, and that order is conceded by to exist by the parties, even though an actual copy, a signed copy, doesn't appear. It's referenced in all the pleadings. So the long and short of all of that is the claim that's brought in the second lawsuit does not have to be the same claim that was resolved on the merits in the first lawsuit. As long as one of the claims or some of the claims in the first lawsuit went to a final judgment on the merits, then any other claim that was brought but not prosecuted, any other claim that could have been brought arising out of the same transaction or subject matter under the transactional test, any claim that could have been brought, that's all barred by res judicata.
So what
do you say about appellant's contention that non-suits are effective the moment that they are filed? Because in this case, we later have an amended non-suit. So if they're effective the time that they're filed, how do you get to an amended non-suit?
Well, the problem is, though, that the trial court expressly refused to accept the non-suits with respect to the defamation claim. So
only to the defamation claim.
I agree, but that means there was a claim pending at the time that the counterclaim was filed and the case was alive. So
that was going to be my question, actually, Justice DeHaney. Now, mm-hmm. So when the non-suit seems to be atypical in that they try to non-suit everything. I mean, they try to non-suit the defamation, and that's why the trial court said no, because we had issued an opinion. And while that is pending, there is a lawsuit pending. So even though the non-suit, in my head, I'm doing a law school analysis, mm-hmm. I'm thinking there's still a live mm-hmm. lawsuit when the counterclaims are filed.
Mm-hmm. And then the other complication, too, is that only Richard Galvan had filed...
Right.
Because the non-suit before the counterclaims were filed. The non-suit bearing both of their signatures was not e-filed until after the counterclaim.
And that was going to be my follow-up.
So,
I did not realize that. I knew that Richard Galvan had filed it and then realized that Sonia Galvan pro se. Mm-hmm. So isn't there also, at least we could split the argument that the counterclaim when filed, there was definitely a claim by Sonia Galvan still pending.
That's certainly true.
Because her non-suit had not been filed.
I think that's true, but you also have the court's express ruling that was never challenged, that the non-suits were absolutely ineffective to remove the defamation claims. And that's the April 28th, 2020 order that's in the record. I want to quickly talk about the second issue, which is, you know, the claims that were raised or could have been raised in the first lawsuit. You have to show that there's an identity there. The claims are exactly the same.
The appellant seems to argue both in their brief and here this morning that even though they all arise out of the sexual assault that occurred in 2007, correctly or wrong, but really his claims arise once the depositions were taken and we were noted that things that they alleged were false. They give rise now to the malicious prosecution, right? Mm-hmm. And we're not the same as those in the counterclaim.
Well, here's the thing. They are actually pleaded in the counterclaim. A malicious prosecution claim was pleaded in the counterclaim. And this idea that we needed to take a deposition to get evidence before we file the claim is undermined by all of their own pleadings, because if you look in numerous pleadings, including the counterclaims in the 2018 lawsuit, which was before the depositions, and in all their petitions in the 2020 lawsuit, they make allegations that the Cruises that the Galvans had admitted their conduct to the Cruises and to others, and so they have been making that allegation from the beginning that when confronted that they conceded what had happened, and so. You know, and the allegations about assault were alleged directly against Mr. Cruz. So if Mr. Cruz was present and he knew that what they were saying was false, he didn't need to do any depositions. He has his own testimony. That whole argument simply doesn't hold any water, because they've been claiming that they had evidence of this from the beginning, and from even before they took the deposition.
What about their claim that for the malicious prosecution that they actually need they need finality in that one first before they can bring a lawsuit, and that would be the end of the defamation suit?
So the same problem. Their own pleadings undermine that argument. In fact, Mr. Chapman stood up here today and said that claim is derivative of this court's decision. And so in pleadings all throughout the 2018 litigation, in the pleadings in the 2020 litigation, they say things like, Galvan's claims have been adjudicated on the merits by the 13th Court of Appeals. Galvan's proceeding was terminated by the 13th Court of Appeals. The Galvan's proceeding was terminated by the 13th Court of Appeals. And at the time that this court ruled on the SLAPP motion, the court decided at that point that the trial court had to dismiss the defamation claim but had to retain the claim for attorney's fees. There was no further appellate proceeding that could come from that could further challenge the actual dismissal of the claim against the Cruises, which is the basis for a malicious prosecution. You have to have a termination of the prosecution in your favor to be a plaintiff for malicious prosecution. The minute this court's mandate issued and it said, trial court, you have to vacate your order and enter an order dismissing that claim, that ship has sailed. There is no further appeal from that. So at that point, the claim accrued, and that is the position that the Cruises have taken throughout all of this litigation until we get to this summary judgment proceeding. And it's in their pleadings. So, and Your Honor, one of the cases, the Zurita case that I referenced earlier, the doctor and the dentist, dealt with a very similar allegation. The dentist said, "Oh well, those counterclaims that got stricken, those actually didn't accrue until post judgment, and I didn't really have a claim." And the Court of Appeals said, "But you pleaded it, so you clearly thought you had it, and you can't really come back now and say, well, it wasn't really mature when you already pleaded it and allowed it to go to judgment and then didn't appeal the judgment to preserve that claim." I see my time is about to run out, and so I'll just ask that for all those reasons that have been provided and that will be provided in our letter brief, that the court affirm the judgment and end this litigation once and for all. And if the court doesn't have any other questions, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Vaughn. Champion. If at any time you want to file a reply or response to the letter brief, I'm assuming that it's just going to be cites and no argument, yeah. Ms. Voss. Just cites.
If that's the court's order.
That's the court's order. Just cites. No.
Just cites. Okay.
No. Just so that we make sure we have the cites correct. But if at any time you want to provide supplemental cites to those, you may, Mr. Champion.
Okay. Just cites, Your Honor.
Just cites.
Okay.
We understand the arguments.
Okay. My timer has started. There is no evidence of an adjudication in this case. Page 12 of the appellee's own brief, the order of clarification does not state the counterclaims are dismissed with prejudice expressly. That's the beginning, middle, and end of this thing.
Okay, so let me stop you there, and I know that you have a lot to say and you only have 5 minutes. But when your counterclaims are filed, the only non-suit that has occurred is the one by Richard Gavon. So isn't Sonia Gavon's claim still open?
No, Your Honor. Richard Gavon attempted to non-suit the case for both him and Sonia. And
but an attempt is not a non-suit, Mr. Champion.
Well, the trial court determined that because they were pro se, that was effective. No one appealed it. They didn't appeal that. I certainly didn't. And however we consider the trial court's errors, that's what stuck.
Okay.
So you're correct in your previous statement, I think, that simply once I filed counterclaims, the trial court ruled there was nothing to attach them to in this cause number, that being the 2018 cause number. But I do have a lot of things to get to if I can proceed. Ms. Voss may not like prior counsel for the Galvan's position, but with respect to how the court granted this motion for clarification, she's bound by the position they took then, which was that the non-suits were effective the very first time they were filed and wiped out everything else. And she's bound by that because that's the court's
reason. Well, they didn't wipe everything out. They didn't wipe out the defamation.
I'll address that as well. this court's opinion ruled on the anti-SLAPP motion, referred it back to the trial court for subsequent rulings. Much like when I used to, in a different lifetime, argue 4590I dismissals for doctors, we would have a dismissal. The case would be gone. In other words, the defamation was gone, but the sanctions claim lives after the case because I filed my sanctions claim virtually with my answer. So that was what was heard in June, but that case was not fully decided until then because the court could have still made errors with respect to fees, things, and the anti-SLAPP. That hearing was expressly about relief under the anti-SLAPP previously pled.
But doesn't that keep, I mean, we have had, there's a whole slew of case law, Mr. Champion, that says that, because there's been a lot of, under the 4590I, which I still remember defending, where they would try to non-suit, as you said earlier, as your clients were trying to avoid sanctions.
Yeah.
So they tried a non-suit and then refile later on. It keeps alive the case because the court has to keep the case alive in order to ascertain sanctions, attorney's fees, and fees.
For the purpose of the sanctions only.
Well, how can it be only purpose for that and not your counterclaim, anybody's counterclaim that comes in?
Again, very quickly, that's a nullity sort of in this case because the court determined, and it's clear from the motion for clarification, which is now in the record and the order, that the non-suits, and if the court was wrong, that's in the can, so to speak, the non-suits wiped out any ability of me to file counterclaims. So we refiled them in a different case. I need to address a couple of other things, okay, if I may. The new case is Ms. Voss cited, the one about the dentist. The sleight of hand there was that the court struck that counterclaim for being untimely. I would certainly agree that a decision on the merits that it was untimely is on the merits. That's not the case here. These were not struck that way. These were just determined that they were not filed until after the non-suits, therefore couldn't be filed. With respect to the class action case, that was that attorney winnowing down his cases, not the other side. A non-suit with prejudice or without prejudice by the other side is not going to do anything but set the parties back to where they were. That's a black letter case law. Otherwise, we are going to enter into a future, an unintended future, where a party that fears liability might file suit and then non-suit his claim so he can get out of potential liability. That's where this logic that they're claiming is headed, is that there's going to be a case where somebody worries about getting sued, they file a suit, and then non-suit. And then say, whoa, we non-suited. Claims are done. That's not the law in this state. There's no evidence of that. There's no evidence of an adjudication. There's no argument or evidence on the merits of the compulsory counterclaim waiver in their original summary judgment motion. All the cases regarding waiver about having to take this appeal from the other case have a decision on the merits somewhere in the other case. An untimely filed claim, an abuse of the non-suit rule, the plaintiff themselves non-suiting their cases, not the other sides. So we simply have no evidence of an adjudication because there was none. And they can't make one up now arguing differently than they argued in the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you. If there's nothing else, this case is under submission. Thank you.